I'm talking once again to Janice Arnold-Jones. Welcome to Women's Focus.
Nice to see you again. It's been way too long.
Well, I want to go back a little bit and tell some people about your past, and then we'll talk about the campaign, the current campaign. But I think that listeners might not know something that you told me a long time ago about helping to start the Rape Crisis Center in Albuquerque before you left the state at that point. So tell me about that.
Well, I would say, so I was part of that initial effort, but my focus was as a team led by Ann Bingaman, Betty Reed, Marion Matthews, and Kathy Liebeck, and Dr. Kaufman. We wrote the criminal sexual conduct code that is on the books today. We replaced a law that had pretty well stood the test of time since about 1863. It was dreadful, dreadful. And probably the most pivotal policy experience in my life, and Ann Bingaman was a taskmaster, and she would say, you must watch the words, this law must stand for 25 years without amendment. That is the standard. It was very interesting to write to that standard. And I think we, to a large extent, with one teeny tiny adjustment, because we made a political trade-off. I know you're surprised to hear that. But the bill was really important. So the trade-off, I believe, came about eight years later. And that was to get rid of interspousal immunity. And we tried when we passed it, but we couldn't get the bill passed. That was in the dark ages. We started in 73. It was signed March 20th, 1975.
Oh, nice.
But who's counting?
And tell me what interspousal immunity means.
In the dark ages, so under this previous law, if you were a woman and you were sexually assaulted and you had a disability to include a broken leg, you were worth a lesser penalty to the state of New Mexico. That's how awful this bill was. At that time, if you were a woman who was married to a man, then it was assumed you could not be raped. And that is what interspousal immunity is. And, of course, we all know that is absolutely not true at all.
Okay. So. And I actually remember when we passed the law that made it that you could, that it was rape, right, even if you were married.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And do you remember who the sponsor was?
It was Dennis, wasn't it?
No. It was Raymond Sanchez.
Oh, was it?
I believe it was Raymond Sanchez. I was not in the state at the time when it happened, but I understood that he picked up the gauntlet and carried it. But I wouldn't be surprised if Dennis did that too.
Okay.
So, you know.
And were you involved in starting the Women's Political Caucus too?
I was one of the early members of the Women's Political Caucus. And Tasha Young. Who else was there? Well, Kathy Liebeck was there, but I'm trying to remember who else. Donna Smith was there, but I'm trying to remember who really carried the load. I want to say it was Tasha. I mean, she was like a woman with her hair on fire. She was just amazing. But I may be misremembering. It's been a while.
Okay, and then you left the state and eventually came back.
I did. I married the love of my life, John Jones, in 1975. He joined the Navy, which was a very interesting experience. And so we traveled around the world for about 22 years and then came back to the state in 1994.
Then you were in the legislature, of course, and that's where people know you the most, I think. And I think that what you're most widely known for was recording the hearings.
Webcasting. Isn't it amazing to go to a legislature and you and I both know we work on policy, and I get known for something that had nothing to do with piece of legislation, but it was really important, and I'm grateful, but I'm also very sad that it still took a full 8 years to get where we needed to be, which was not only webcasting of everything, but open archiving, so you as a citizen at any time could go back and look at that record.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was incredibly important.
Yes.
And of course, as you know, the guys on all sides were really mad at me. You remember this? Yeah. They were.
I remember you sitting there and sort of just looking straight ahead and not looking at the looks that were coming at you.
Well, as I recall, the speaker's face was a different shade of purple than I'd ever seen before. It was an interesting time, but it was the right thing. And you know what? I think they all knew it. It was just sometimes being pushed into doing the right thing is difficult. Mm-hmm. And I don't want you to think I didn't ask permission. I did. But I got patted on the head so many times that I said, after a couple of years, that was enough.
And it's funny how it's so accepted now, and everyone just assumes that everything will be recorded, except for the conference committees and things like that.
I would say, I thought that the recent changes included the conference committees, but it should. It's your government, but as you know, my belief is whatever I tell you here, I should be able to say in public, or maybe I shouldn't say it. And I believe that should be the standard in our legislature.
Okay. Well, let's talk about in the legislature some of the things that you actually worked on besides doing that.
Well, probably, there were a number of tax bills. There were other bills that if you wanted to get them passed, you gave to someone else. I was always in the minority, and so oftentimes legislation would go to the other side, and I was perfectly fine with that as long as it got done. Mm-hmm. Probably the most interesting piece and a very good example of that was a bill on interoperability. And again, you may not remember back then, this is right after 9/11, we had cities, counties, towns, and states where the emergency response personnel could not talk with one another, nor did we have a requirement that their equipment be interoperable when they replaced it. And this was not very sexy, but it was really important that that standard be established so that if the Sandoval County Fire Department bought new equipment, that they also be able to talk to the Bernalillo County Fire Department, because we share borders and we have to rely on one another. And now we don't even think about it because most systems, most platforms like Microsoft and Apple are now interoperable. But in 2002, they were not.
I've been doing some discussions and interviews and sort of seeking whether women who get to a certain place, an elected office or a head of committee, whether they actually have power or they just have the title. And I've also talked to Diane Snyder about what it was like, whether you had power if you were in the party that was out of power. So let's talk a little bit about that. I especially remember you leading a lot of the discussion on the floor, sort of being the Republican who was leading the questioning when bills came down. But let's talk about whether you felt that you had power or not.
Did I have power? I was certainly very well aware at times that I had no power. One of the worst experiences I had was when the TID for Mesa del Sol came down. And I was new, but I knew what the rules were. And the amendments came directly from the people who were submitting them. They had not gone through the council service. So they were not in the correct format as far as I was concerned, but I wasn't allowed to read it. And so I asked for a 5-minute recess to read about 20 pages. Mm. And the speaker said no. And they voted on it. And it was one of the few votes that I ever walked away from. I was so mad. And then when I was on the floor, I was the only vote against this piece of legislation because I thought it was seriously flawed. And as you know, we've had some serious issues with the TIDs and the PIDs. Mm-hmm. So when I made what I thought was a very reasonable request, was it clear I had no power? I had no power and I was ticked. But did I have influence? I did. And I don't know if it's because I'm always focused on what was most important to our constituents or the state. But I think if you have credibility, people will listen to you. And probably one of the greatest compliments that I recall as we're debating on the floor, Gail Chasey stood up and she goes, I'm not sure I know what that word is, interoperability, but if Janice says we should do it, we should do it. Oh. It was quite a compliment, but I did know what I was talking about, and I think they sensed that. But influence and power are two very different things. Mm-hmm. So was I able to, on the floor, through my own power, change the way things happened? I would say no. But I did have influence. And you worked very hard to get that. I was grateful. But was I driving the ship? Oh, please, not driving the ship. I didn't even have the tiller.
But that was a sense of women working together also.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and one of the really funny instances of women who we almost had a revolt, but our chief clerk, the clerk of the house, changed the lock on the ladies' bathroom. And as you know, at that time, we had to use a broom closet. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a very inconvenient location, and you had to have a key. And there are some older members, and we had to walk all the way down. He didn't tell a soul that he had changed the key, so they would trundle down to the ladies' room. Doing this between votes is always challenging. And then they had to go back to the floor, at which point he said, well, you have to go see the sergeant at arms. Did that sound a little passive-aggressive to you? I thought so. And so Cheryl Stapleton Williams stood up on the floor and said, you know, absolutely, this will stop. And, you know, she has this wonderful, profunda voice. And I can remember the speaker, he just stopped, and he got the chief clerk, and he said, you will issue those keys. But it's on the small things. So we had those wins. What about the big things? You know, and many of the women legislators were passionate about the budget, things that affected people's lives every day. Did we have as great a voice or as powerful a voice? I would argue probably not. We had influence. Mm. There is a difference.
Well, what kept you coming back then?
Even without the power, the influence still made changes. Being able to sit at my house and watch a legislative hearing, I'm pretty darn pleased with that. But I also know that, well, I'm the technical person, that the technical pieces sometimes affect your life in a way that is really aggravating, but you don't know why. And it's very gratifying to be able to go in and say, there, right there, and we can fix it. And sometimes it's not very big, but I've always put great value in that your government should be effective, and if I try not to use the word efficient, effective for you, and that your intersection should be not only minimal, but it should be functional and not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that.
Well, another battle that you've had, power battle, is with some parts of your party, especially with the governor. You've been on the outs with the governor from time to time. So talk to me about that, about what were you thinking? What were you trying to do?
Well, you know, I actually don't think I was ever on the outs with the governor. We actually have a very amiable relationship. I did make an error, but nobody told me I had done that. I thought that I would make a very good governor. So I raised my hand in 2009 and decided to run for governor before she even got in the race. Mm-hmm. It didn't bother me that she was there. Her campaign manager, the infamous Jay McCluskey, who referred to me as the effing bitch in the national press, took me by surprise. He was not very nice. But the governor herself, I wouldn't say that there was animosity there, but there was no, speaking of wielding power, any participation that I might have contributed to this administration was not a possibility. I was just not entertained, which I thought was very sad.
Explain that a little bit more for listeners who aren't really aware of how political things work. tell me what that means.
Well, so I'm a good soldier, and I didn't win the primary, and if you don't win, then we're in a party system. You support your candidate. I did that because I believe it's the right thing to do. And so afterwards, there were committees set up, and I was actually nominated to be the Secretary of Tax and Revenue.
Oh.
And I know this, people don't even know that that happened. Didn't get an interview, didn't get nothing. Nothing. In fact, the individual who was ultimately nominated had not even gone before the committees that had been set up. And any other opportunity to participate, it just wasn't there. I was simply not welcome. And nobody said that. It was more like if I made a phone call, it was never returned, ever. Mm-hmm. And to this day, no phone calls are returned.
Okay.
And I have the cell phone numbers. They're just not returned.
And you attribute that to Jay and not to the governor?
Well, I'd say maybe through time, perhaps she feels that way. But I can't tell you that that's the truth. Because without communication, you don't know. But I do think that it was more the political operative. If it was the governor, then I'm certainly sad to hear that.
Okay, so let's talk about this race that you're in, and that would send you to Washington if you win. I guess I'm saying, tell me why you want to do it.
Well, as you know, going to Congress is certainly not a cakewalk, but I like hard work. But I'm doing it because I love this state, and it needs a representative. And we are at an incredibly important period in our state's history. You know, we cannot remain so static. We cannot remain at the bottom of all of the educational stats. We cannot remain mired in poverty. We cannot remain mired in joblessness. We cannot do this. And our state deserves better. Now, there are things that I've identified in Congress that I know how to do, and I would like to do that for our state. As an example, one of the things I learned in the legislature were some of the FCC rules that actually regulate all of our communication. I don't know if you remember when I ran for governor, I talked about connectivity till I was blue in the face. Now, all these years later, you hear people talking about connectivity, and I had people going, well, you can't talk about connectivity. They won't understand. Give me a break.
Another question that I had was, if organizations from Washington are in contact with you.
So Maggie's List recently endorsed me, and I'm grateful for their support. And these are mostly business policy-oriented groups. So let's talk about my race a little bit.
Okay.
Part of the challenge for me in this race is on the Republican side, many people just assumed that Damon Martinez was going to win, and it didn't happen. And so the change, it was just written off as that's what was going to happen. Well, it didn't happen. And so now there are two strong women running. We are very different in our approaches to policy. And so making sure that those groups that are interested look at it, and when I say those groups, I'm including party, because from here to Washington, D.C. is a long way. And let me remind you of something. The National Weather Person always stands in front of the state of New Mexico, so we're often hidden, and they don't look. You hadn't thought about it, had you?
So what you're trying to get them to notice us.
But the race changed. The race changed dramatically. I mean, I can tell you what the mantra was. Oh, this is a deep blue race. This is not possible. Nobody can win this. And the former U.S. attorney was considered quite moderate and more reflective of the population. I argue that had that happened, that might have been true. But my opponent and I are very different. And so there's going to be a very clear choice. And I have to make sure that people in Washington who might support me recognize this, because at this moment they don't.
Let's talk about issues.
You know, I am pro-life. I have always been that way. I have been a respecter of Roe v. Wade. But I have always abhorred the fact that the state of New Mexico is the single largest purveyor of late-term abortions. The state can fix this. It's a state issue. It's not a federal issue. But life is incredibly important to me. And I'm not trying to step on choices, but we as women have control. We do. And I believe that we should execute as much control about our lives as we possibly can and not just kind of float along. We have to take control, and that really gets down to the core of those issues.
I don't think I know what you mean by take control. In what way?
Well, I would say, so if we're talking about choice, so you and I both have a choice, unless we are forced, as to when we have intercourse. And if we have protection, we have those choices. We have to exercise those choices. We have to choose. And do I understand that people mess up? Yeah, I do. But I believe that sometimes when we mess up, maybe it's a gift. Maybe it's a gift.
As you are a former businesswoman, as I remember, mm-hmm. so I wondered what you think about family leave.
Oh, sure. So I think most businesses that want to attract good employees are supporting family leave. Almost everybody who has a business, especially if it's a larger business, understand that happy employees are a really good thing. But they also have children, and they understand the tug with family leave. Probably the more difficult piece for family leave is not the child piece, it's the parent piece, mm-hmm. which in many ways is much more difficult. Children are really quite portable, and grown-ups are not so portable and actually take a different kind of time. So I think it's important that businesses continue to do this, and I think it's the right policy. I believe our government is already there. We're very lucky in this area because we have so much government contracting that standard is being met. Where we end up at cross purposes is at some of the smaller businesses and in some of the minimum wage jobs, where the business has a choice to either support that policy or simply stay with part-time workers. And that's a really difficult one to get across. And I'm not quite sure how we're going to get there, but I think we will.
But do you think the state should tell the businesses what to do or should encourage them in some way, like with taxes, tax breaks and things?
So like I said, larger businesses are already doing this because it's good for the business. It's good for business. That's the point. It is good for business. And a business that's going to stay in business wants to keep their employees. So I'm always on the side of, first and foremost, of allowing us to choose to do the right thing. Do I think it will be effective? So one of the challenges of legislating is if you force businesses to do X and they simply close their door, did we win? We didn't win. So can we find the middle ground? Let's solve the problem. And so I don't have a magic wand, but I know that, you know, maybe tax incentives are the issue. Some of the apprenticeship programs, I'm looking at the way that they're structured at the national level. Maybe that would be a better way to structure things. So how do we take care of people? And let's go back to when you have to take care of your parents. If you happen to be working at a fast food restaurant, how does that work and how does that work for the employer? Because the margin is usually less than 3%. It becomes a very difficult question. So do we find other jobs? What do we do? I don't have the answer for it.
What about another big issue, immigration and dealing with immigrants? And so what are your thoughts about that?
How much time do you have? I have always been one that I want people to want the American dream. I want people to come here. I want them to do it legally. I want them to raise their hand and say, I want to be an American. I want to do that. Have we made a mess of things? We have not enforced our own laws. We have systems that don't work. We really, quite frankly, have a mess. Send me to Congress, because I have some ideas that we can fix. So let's talk about workers in New Mexico. And so we have a really interesting problem going on in our state. As you noticed, we have the lowest unemployment that we've ever had in our state. We also have the lowest new jobs rate as well. Part of our problem is we don't have enough workers. And I will tell you what, any day, I will take a worker from Mexico who comes here legally because they are the hardest working people I have ever met in my life. Why are we making this so difficult? What if for our day workers or weekly workers, 2 weeks, why don't we set up some kiosks in Juarez and Jalisco and Chihuahua? Let them do all of the registration, use some biometrics, and make this easy. We need the workers, and we need to be open and forthright about it for the safety of those workers as well as for our own people. That's what would make it work. And yet, have you heard anybody say, let's put up some kiosks? There are answers. Clearly making sure that we have appropriate tools, but the backlog on the paperwork and the hearings, it is just a wonder to me. And let me just add something else. I have been incensed for years that for people who come here wanting to be an American citizen, that it takes so long and that it costs so much money. I don't think either one of those things are in our interest. As you know, I have always been more on the, you know, they're never just three issues, never. You know, I want to talk national security. We're not done with tax policy. Clearly, health care is a huge issue. Immigration is another one. Regulation, all the way. I mean, there are so many issues that we need to talk about. Do they all impact women? Every single one of them. And one of the things that I do want to look at is, as we are looking at housing, and housing is a huge issue for everybody, but in particular for women, how do we make housing affordable? And you have to go more than saying, don't move to San Francisco, you can't afford it. Mm-hmm. That is not going to work. How do we do this? And what are the rules for doing, for example, low-income housing? One of the things that I find particularly troublesome is that we will have intact families that go into low-income housing, but through a number of machinations, the father is not allowed to be there. When the father is not there, oftentimes any other money is not there. And it really puts the women, the mothers, at a disadvantage. Mm. So can we look at those things? Were you around when we were talking about IDAs many, many years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I haven't changed. And when I look at when we help citizens, that we don't put them in the position of saying, yes, I need help now, but then they can never get out. But we have rules that say you can't save money. You cannot receive a gift. You cannot do the things that give you stability so that if you get out of those types of situations where the government is helping you, that you will be able to stand on your own 2 feet. I find that to be a backward policy.
You talked about sending messages to the White House. Let's talk about what your stance is about Trump.
Well, I would say my stance about the president is he is the president. And I'm a constitutionalist. I don't care who is in that office. They have earned my respect because a whole bunch of Americans voted for them. I'm not required to agree with them, but they have my respect. That's the first thing. The second thing is we were invited to communicate, which I really appreciate, which included, if you disagree, just, you know, let us know. We'll have it, you know, have a and that has happened. In this case, I was just telling you about immigration, and I made a suggestion, and they chose another path. That's just how it is. And you know, that happens a lot. When we started, he was not my first choice. The language and the tweeting, I thought, was coarse. It offended my ears. But I will tell you what I learned working under Marty Chavez and Bill Richardson is that it's really important that you look at policy and not personality. Mm-hmm. And so I try to focus on the policies that are working. And if you ask me about his policies, I'm pretty pleased. Mm-hmm. I am very pleased. I just left another business Sunday afternoon who has just opened a second store. They've hired 2 more employees. There's a business down in the valley that has just brought on 4 employees, and they're going to bring on 2 more in September. Because the way that the tax has changed in 2017 made it possible for them to do that. I am very excited about that. I am also thrilled that whether you like the style, again, this is not personality, this is policy. Whether you like the style or not, I think it is always better to talk to people. I never thought in our lifetime we would have a meaningful discussion with North Korea. I didn't think that was possible. I don't know that it will come to fruition. But I know that having that eyeball-to-eyeball communication is better than not.
Okay.
And so I'm pleased with that. If you ask me, do I wish he would quit tweeting? Yeah. But I also understand that as our media changed and as the party structures changed, his only chance was to go around it, and he did. And do not underestimate what he did. I kind of look at it and I'm going, whoa, I did not have the foresight to see what he saw. And you may not agree, but he's there. We're not.
What if he were to make the offer to come and campaign for you? Would you run towards it or away from it?
Do you know what? I think any time, so would I run towards it or away from it? I'm not going to run away from it. Any time a president comes to your state, it is good for your state.
Tell me about what you've been finding as you go door to door.
The people who answer the door, it's still the most remarkable experience. I find at the door, people will tell you what the problem is. And most remarkably, they will tell you how to fix it. and they're usually right.
Thanks for talking to us.
Oh, Susan, it is always wonderful to see you, and we should do this much more frequently.
Okay, good.
Thank you.